KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We're keenly focused on paring away excess administrators while increasing the number of scientists and frontline health providers.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants to cut 20,000 jobs from his agency.
Today is Thursday, March 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump's pause on tariffs on some Canadian products is set to expire next week,
which could hurt small newspapers that rely on newsprint from Canada.
Population and readership is older. Older readers like paper products. I do too.
Also, a new study finds that U.S. and European cuts to foreign aid programs could mean millions of new HIV cases.
And the city of Corpus Christi remembers the singer Selena Quintanilla 30 years after her death.
We see her, I think, as, you know, a barrio girl, a home girl, somebody who was there with us.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Lawyers who represent unaccompanied minors in immigration court are suing the Trump administration after their federal funding was cut. NPR's Joel Rose reports contracts with several nonprofits were terminated last week.
These nonprofits provide legal services for unaccompanied minors who enter the U.S. without a parent or guardian. The Department of Health and Human Services announced last week that it was terminating nearly all of those services. That will leave 26,000 children at risk of losing their attorneys, the nonprofits say, and will prevent many more from getting any legal assistance. The lawsuit, filed in Northern California, argues that Congress has passed laws requiring these legal services to continue and urges the court to block their cancellation and restore federal funding. Joel Rose, NPR News.
U.S. newspapers are watching expected Trump administration tariffs on Canadian timber products with concern. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce says the majority of American newsprint comes from Canada.
25% tariffs on Canadian lumber products are set to go into effect on April 2nd. That includes newsprint paper. Trade group News Media Alliance predicts small rural papers will be hit hardest by higher print prices. Brian Orr owns the World Journal newspaper in tiny Walsenburg, Colorado. He says the higher prices would be devastating.
I'm just crossing my fingers, hoping that it doesn't come to that.
Other groups, such as the U.S. Lumber Coalition, have praised the proposed tariffs. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Colorado Springs.
Meanwhile, according to a new analysis, the cities most likely to feel the bite from the Trump administration's newly launched trade war with Canada are some of the places that helped put him in office. A report by Canada's Chamber of Commerce finds areas like San Antonio and Detroit topping the list of 41 metro areas most dependent on exports from Canada. Members of the National Transportation Safety Board were the congressional hot seat. Lawmakers questioned about preliminary findings on deadly mid-air collision at Reagan National Airport in January. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the crash has intensified scrutiny over aviation safety protocols.
Senator Tammy Duckworth is a former Army helicopter pilot. She warned lawmakers that these types of incidents and near misses are becoming way too common.
We've seen deadly crashes in Philadelphia and Alaska, a crash landing in Toronto that miraculously everyone survived even after the aircraft flipped upside down. Earlier this month, we saw passengers standing on the wing of an A-737 aircraft in Denver to escape a fire.
Congested airspace in the Washington, D.C. area has become a major concern. Lawmakers discuss potential policy changes, including restricting certain helicopter flights near the airport and enhancing communication protocols between air traffic control and pilots. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. The University of Maryland has named its 2025 commencement speaker. As NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, it's a high-profile get who's no stranger to public speaking.
In a dramatic video, the University of Maryland uses on-screen captions to extol its commencement speaker's credentials as an environmental advocate, best-selling author, and friend to all creatures. The video only reveals his identity at the very end when he appears on screen.
I guess it's me.
Kermit the Frog has done plenty of public speaking in the past, including one other commencement address. That was in 1996 at Southampton College, then part of Long Island University. The Muppet has also given out awards at the Oscars, and he's lobbied for animal rights on Capitol Hill. Kermit the Frog is scheduled to give the graduates of the University of Maryland their send-off on May 21st. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
While true believers might have been hoping red marks found on a communion host at a Catholic church in Indiana would turn out to be miraculous, a closer examination has apparently determined not so much. Discovery at St. Anthony Catholic Church in Morris, Indiana was unusual enough to prompt an investigation where chemical analysis turned up fungus and bacteria commonly found on human hands. According to the Catholic faith, consecrated wine and bread wafer signify the body and blood of Christ at Mass. Stocks closed mostly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow fell 155 points to 42,299. The Nasdaq dropped 94 points. The S&P was down 18 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. The Trump administration plans to restructure the federal health agencies, cutting a total of 20,000 jobs. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced the plan this morning, and NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to tell us more. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so 20,000 jobs just seems like a lot. What is going on here?
Well, it is a lot. HHS is the umbrella agency that includes the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Medicare, Medicaid, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and other smaller divisions. And when President Trump came into office, there were 82,000 employees across all of HHS. Secretary Kennedy says many employees have already left or been fired, and with all of that, plus the jobs they're going to eliminate with this new restructuring plan, they would end up with 62,000 employees. That is a 25% reduction.
Wow. What is the rationale for such a huge staff cut?
Secretary Kennedy says HHS is a huge bureaucracy filled with silos, and he says the goal of this restructuring is to streamline. Here he is in a video he posted to social media this morning.
We're keenly focused on paring away excess administrators while increasing the number of scientists and frontline health providers so that we can do a better job for the American people.
He said he wants HHS staff to have a sense of mission, that they're improving America's health, which does lag behind a lot of other countries, and he promised they would do more with less.
Okay. Well, this isn't just a plan to cut staff, right? Like, there's also a restructuring part to all this.
Right. And the plans are really quite dramatic. The number of divisions would go from 28 to 15. For example, the agency that oversees preparedness and emergency response will become part of CDC. The Administration for Community Living, which does work with seniors and people with disabilities, will get split apart and moved into other agencies. And there's also going to be a new division called the Administration for a Healthy America, which seems to be a reference to Kennedy's slogan, Make America Healthy Again. That will be made up of five agencies, including one on toxic substances and mental health and more.
What's been the broader reaction to this plan?
I talked to former HHS Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius this afternoon. She and many others were really skeptical at this idea that you can cut 25% of staff of HHS and not affect the work. For instance, Kennedy says FDA staff is going to be cut by 3,500 people, but that, quote, this reduction will not affect drug, medical device, or food reviewers, nor will it impact inspectors. I asked Sebelius about that.
That's what I find so incredibly insulting. To me, what they're saying is there are 20,000 people working for HHS who do nothing.
She was especially critical of the plan to cut the number of regional offices from 10 to 5 and to combine certain agencies. Like, she questioned how it would help efficiency to combine CDC, which is in Atlanta, with the Strategic Preparedness Agency, which is in D.C. Democratic lawmakers slammed the plan overall. Also, they called for hearings about it. Others vowed to fight it. Republican lawmakers were pretty quiet.
Okay, so what's the timeline real quick for how this will all unfold?
A notice sent from HHS to union contacts obtained by NPR says that people whose jobs are being cut could get notified as soon as tomorrow, and the probable date for those cuts to take effect is May 27th.
Whew, that is NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thank you, Selena.
Thank you.
A pause in President Trump's tariffs on some products from Canada is set to expire next week. America's small newspapers are watching closely. They operate on very thin margins already, and most U.S. newsprint comes from Canada. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
I'm in the newsroom of the World Journal newspaper in tiny Walsenburg, Colorado. Brian Orr owns the paper.
It's a grandiose name for a very little paper that has just a very little footprint.
The World Journal actually covers about 10,000 square miles on the Colorado-New Mexico border, but only about 30,000 people live here.
They ever want to advertise.
And it's a family operation. Brian's wife is co-publisher. His daughter does art direction. The rugged territory the World Journal covers has big gaps in reliable internet coverage and a readership that's not that into online news anyway.
Population and readership is older. Older readers like paper products. I do too.
This month, the Trump administration put a 25% tariff on Canadian timber products that includes newsprint. Not good, says Orr.
Just devastating to have to pay that much more in printing.
President Trump then suspended the tariff, but that suspension is supposed to expire April 2nd.
I'm just crossing my fingers, hoping that it doesn't come to that.
The industry trade group, News Media Alliance, says 80% of newsprint used in America comes from Canada and predicts small rural papers will be hit hardest. Some could close. The Walsenburg World Journal is printed here at the press of the Santa Fe New Mexican. Circulation manager Josh Harris says they print 75 publications for clients in several states.
We have made a lot of sacrifices over the years to make sure that we can keep printing people and make sure that they, you know, keep coming back and that their businesses remain viable. And you can't do that if you are charging people into the dirt.
Notably, this plant actually sources most of its newsprint from American suppliers. Nevertheless,
if everything else is going up 25%, then American suppliers are probably going to try to get 10 to 12 just because you can't get it anywhere else. Right? It is capitalism.
He's absolutely right. We've done a lot of studies of tariffs in the past.
Economist Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics has been studying trade policy for six decades.
And generally speaking, U.S. producers of similar products raise their prices.
The Trump administration says its tariffs will reinvigorate America's hollowed out industries. Huffbauer says, yes, tariffs can help some domestic producers in those protected industries. For example, the U.S. Lumber Coalition has voiced strong support for Trump's move. Huffbauer says on the whole, though,
high tariffs have not historically been a path to a robust manufacturing sector.
In theory, he says tariffs on Canadian newsprint could stimulate more U.S. production, but
it's going to take a while. Not easy to open a new newsprint factory in the U.S.
Paper mills are notorious local polluters. Communities are often reluctant to approve their construction. Brian Orr, Walsenburg World Journal publisher, says they're looking for ways to buy less paper.
If I can get someone to convert from being a physical paper reader to a digital reader.
He's pushing online subscriptions, maybe delivering fewer copies to newsstands. He says prices would have to rise if the tariffs on Canada stick. But
there are a significant demographic of my population that just likes a newspaper. So that we will always print a newspaper.
For NPR News,
we will never give up on paper.
I'm Dan Boyce in Walsenburg, Colorado.
Horses are exceptional athletes, able to push their large bodies further and faster than just about any other animal. A new study in the journal Science suggests that an unusual genetic change might be behind that athleticism. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
To run far and fast, cells need a lot of energy. But the process cells use to produce that energy has a cost, explains Vanderbilt University biologist Gianni Castiglione.
You know, to make energy, we've made a deal with the devil to basically have a slow-burning fire in our cells.
That fire essentially burns oxygen to make energy, but that creates a lot of smoke or oxidative stress that can cause cellular damage. Antioxidants can mitigate this damage, and animals regulate this balance through a key gene pathway called NRFP-KEEP1.
To not get burned, you need this NRF2 system. This is essentially the energy production and fire department, all wrapped in one of the cell.
Castiglione and his colleagues wanted to see if any animals had evolved workarounds to this trade-off. They scanned the genomes of nearly 200 mammalian species looking for unusual variants to this system. Horses stood out with a single strange mutation.
This is a type of mutation called a nonsense mutation, and that's because what it does is inactivates the gene from doing what the cell needs it to do.
It does that by essentially inserting a stop sign, called a stop codon, in the middle of that key gene instead of just at the end. This mutation kills mice, probably because it allows too much smoke to build up in cells. So Castiglione was stumped.
We have to dig really deep and try to figure out what exactly is going on here.
Through a variety of genetic and molecular techniques, Castiglione and his colleagues discovered that horses evolved a way to go around that extra stop sign.
We found that horses have somehow come up with a back door, so to speak, where they've changed the interpretation of the genetic code. So it doesn't mean break this protein, it means do something different.
That's something, which they still don't fully understand, allows horse cells to produce up to 5 times more energy than mouse cells while simultaneously ramping up their damage control system by 200%. This combination of mutations allows their muscle cells to basically run hotter than other animals, says Ilya Du, a study co-author and researcher at Johns Hopkins University.
This provides them with the biochemical means to run fast and over long distances. They've ascended into that pantheon of the greatest athletes among animals.
Samantha Brooks, a genetics researcher at the University of Florida, agrees that these mutations helped horses become aerobic powerhouses. And to her, the paper also shows just how weird evolution can be.
Stop codons are generally in genetics considered to be bad news, and it really should have caused a catastrophic loss of function for this protein. But instead, the ancestors here of these species somehow managed to really turn that lemon into lemonade.
This adaptation in horses could have implications for human health. Many inherited diseases, like cystic fibrosis and muscular dystrophy, stem from stop codons arising in important genes. The researchers hope that understanding how horses evolved workarounds might inspire new treatments in humans. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Consider the past 6 months in the mountains of southern Appalachia. Hurricane Helene brought catastrophic flooding to places like Asheville, North Carolina. But lately, it's been so windy and dry that the Carolinas are currently fighting wildfires. The North Carolina Forest Service has declared one of them the highest priority fire in the U.S. Now, wildfires are not new to this region, but the strength, frequency, and size of these blazes, that is new. To talk about this more, we're going to bring in somebody who has spent 25 years studying fires like these, Rob Scheller. He's a professor of landscape ecology at North Carolina State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Scott.
What's the best way to describe what's going on right now in the Carolinas and in the broader Southeast? How serious is the fire risk? How has this changed from before?
The fire risk is elevated and it is severe. We do need to be taking precautions. This is a combination, of course, of dry spring, which is not unusual for the area, but it is a dry spring in combination with elevated fuel loads over a wide area due to Hurricane Helene. Hurricane Helene damaged over 800,000 acres of forest. And so just think about a lot of tree mortality, limbs falling, and so on. And so that all lands on a forest floor. And once it gets dried out, this is fantastic fuel for a fire.
Is it fair to say then that the massive population growth that you've seen throughout so much of the Southeast is a big factor here? I mean, I think one example, Greenville, South Carolina, this is one of the communities near one of these fires, gained something like 6 new households every week between 2000 and 2020. This is just massive population growth in this region. How does that affect all of this?
Yeah, the expansion of the wildland-urban interface is a huge factor when we think about fire risk. And it is expanding rapidly across the Southeast. And so more people, there's more opportunities for fires to negatively impact, of course, homes and lives. It's also more opportunities for people to accidentally start fires. And so that's more people living near natural vegetation, having barbecues, maybe doing some burning of yard waste and so on. So it's a two-way risk, both to people and people starting fires as well.
What is the best way to frame it from your perspective on the question, I'm sure you've gotten a lot of, has climate change made this risk worse?
Climate change has made the risk worse, and part of that is just rising temperatures by themselves will allow fuels to dry out faster. The other factor is what we're seeing in the Southeast is precipitation has become much more variable over time. And so last year is a great example where we had a really wet spring followed by a dry summer, and then a wet early fall, and then a really dry later fall. And so that means that you have these flash droughts sprinkled throughout the season, which again allow fuels to dry out and increases fire risk.
Mm-hmm. So obviously temperatures are going up. That's not changing anytime soon.
Nope.
More people are moving to the Southeast. That doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon.
Correct.
What to you are the biggest steps that can be taken to try and mitigate these risks?
Again, there's many sides to the risk story. So one thing you want to do is just reduce the risk of fire spreading, and that requires reducing the amount of fuels on the ground. That means getting out there and doing some salvage logging, maybe doing some prescribed burning. However, that's going to be difficult across over 800,000 acres of rough terrain. And so people also need to be reducing their own risk. And in that case, there's things you can do around vegetation management immediately around your house. Making sure the vegetation is away from the house, making sure you don't have a wood pile near to or up against the house, trying to eliminate any wooden fences. People could also change the way they build new houses. So there's many more fireproof methods of building houses today. And lastly, people just need to be aware of the potential for fire and think about evacuation routes, what they need to grab right away. You don't want to be waiting until the last minute to figure out where the prize family photo album is or the deed to the house, et cetera. You should have all those things ready to go in the case of a fire, because those delays cause mortality.
Yeah. That is Professor Rob Scheller of North Carolina State University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Until the Trump administration halted most U.S. foreign assistance programs, America was the top donor to global health. Now that much of that aid has stopped, researchers have been trying to figure out what the effect is going to be on people's health in low- and middle-income countries. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports on a study looking specifically at HIV and AIDS.
For the past few decades, the world has made progress in preventing and treating HIV. Much of that progress has been paid for by five countries.
That's the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. And together they make up 90% of international funding.
Deborah Ten Brink is at the Burnett Institute, a medical research organization in Melbourne, Australia. She says all of these countries have announced plans to shrink that aid. Brink and her team modeled what this could mean for HIV infections and deaths. Their study was published this week in The Lancet HIV. The study found that if the most extreme cuts go into effect, it could mean taking AIDS back to the peak of the epidemic in the mid-90s.
In 2030, that would mean 3.4 million infections. And we saw in the height of the HIV epidemic, there were 3.3 million HIV infections. So that's a really going back in time by, what is it, 30 years, almost, you know, reverting all that progress.
She says the toll would not be evenly distributed around the world.
So sub-Saharan Africa is, you know, the region with the highest burden and most dependent on international funding. So they would be the hardest hit area by far.
A memo from the Trump administration to Congress that was obtained by NPR suggests many HIV/AIDS programs are being cut, but some will be spared. John Stover is with Avenir Health. It's a nonprofit that does data analysis for public health programs. Stover says the study published in The Lancet was well done, and it's the kind of information a lot of people are looking for right now, including members of Congress who have been getting in touch with researchers like him.
Lots of different groups are trying to provide information to congressmen who are, you know, have to eventually vote on future assistance.
He says the models of how many more people will get sick from AIDS, how many more people will die, they vary a bit. But
when you look at the big picture across all countries supported by U.S. assistance, all the models agree that the impact is tremendous.
One thing that makes the impact so tremendous, he says, is just how abruptly the cuts have been made without a transition plan in place. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
President Trump announced new tariffs this week and is expected to announce more next week. What does it mean for people in China who make so many American consumer goods? I'm Steve Inskeep. We visit the source of a lot of your stuff tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. South Korea has admitted to widespread malpractice by its adoption agencies. We speak with one adoptee about her experience.
I think we all want to know where we come from, and we have a right to know. Who were our parents? Where were we born?
That story's coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's revoked 300 visas for international students, and there could be more. Rubio says the U.S. won't tolerate, quote, creating ruckus, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
On a trip to Guyana, Secretary Rubio was asked about a Turkish student from Tufts University who was arrested by plainclothes ICE agents, apparently over an op-ed she wrote about Gaza. He says he revoked her visa and will do the same with anyone else who vandalizes universities as part of protest movements.
We gave you a visa to come and study and get a degree, not to become a social activist that tears up our university campuses. And if we've given you a visa and then you decide to do that, we're going to take it away. I encourage every country to do that.
He says the U.S. will continue to deport those he calls lunatics. He also talked tough on gang members, defending the decision to deport more than 200 Venezuelans to El Salvador. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, traveling with the secretary in Guyana.
The Trump administration is imposing new 25% tariffs on all foreign-made cars and trucks and certain auto parts beginning next week. President Trump calling it a permanent tax that will likely send both new and used car prices soaring as consumers continue to struggle with rising inflation. The European Union plans to retaliate with tariffs on U.S.-made products. Sigrid Devries with the European Auto Manufacturers Association says the financial impact will be huge.
There are about between 700 and 800,000 vehicles shipped to the U.S. every year, with a value of about short of 40 billion euros. The total number of exports into the U.S. from the whole world by foreign manufacturers is about $200 billion.
On Wall Street, shares of automobile dealers slipped. The Trump administration is imposing new recent public opinion polls in Ukraine show large support for President Zelensky. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley says his support went up more than 10 points after he was berated in the White House by President Trump and Vice President Vance last month.
The Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, which carried out one survey, says it continues to monitor the dynamics of trust in President Zelensky. As of the second half of March, it found that 69% of Ukrainians trust him, with attitudes equal across the country. And concerning elections, 77% of those polled said Ukraine should only hold a presidential ballot after receiving security guarantees or a final peace agreement and a complete end to the war. The polling sample did not include residents of Russian-occupied territories or Ukrainians who moved abroad because of the war. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Pavlograd, Ukraine.
Scientists say Arctic sea ice buildup this winter hit a record low. The region is warming four times faster than the rest of the world, affecting weather conditions elsewhere. Scientists with the National Snow and Ice Data Center say it's another symptom of climate change that, they say, will have repercussions in weather around the globe. The Arctic usually reaches its maximum sea ice in March, then starts to melt over the next 6 months. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. For the first time, the South Korean government is admitting that for decades, the country's adoption agencies were responsible for widespread fraud, malpractice, and even human rights abuses. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission released their initial findings after a years-long investigation into the cases of hundreds of adoptees who were sent to live with families abroad. That report confirms what many of those adoptees, including filmmaker Deanne Borshe Leem, already knew, that they were lied to about who they are. Leem submitted her own case to the commission for review and has also made multiple films about Korean adoptions. Deanne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start, if we can, by just asking you to tell us a little bit about your own adoption experience. At what point did you start to suspect that things weren't what they seemed to be?
I was adopted in 1966 at the age of 8 and was adopted by an American family in California, grew up in Fremont, California. And it wasn't really until college that I started having flashbacks of my life in Korea. These brief images of a little home in the hills, scenes from an orphanage, children running around, shoes on a rack, those kinds of images. And at first I thought they were dreams, but then I realized that maybe they were actual memories. And so I asked my adoptive mother if I could have my adoption records. And as I looked through them, I discovered that there were two pictures, one that was of me and one that was of another girl. And yet on the back of both pictures was the same name, the name that I was adopted with, which was Cha Jung-hee. It was just a transformative moment in my life to know that I had been switched with another child. My adoptive parents knew nothing about it, and that it took, all these years to kind of come to terms with the truth.
I'm wondering what you can tell us based on your own experience and the experience of other Korean adoptees that you have spoken with about how the turbulent beginnings that we've been talking about, how they've affected the lives of these adoptees as well as their families.
You know, it's really difficult. I think we all want to know where we come from, and we have a right to know. Who were our parents? Where were we born? We have a right to our identities. Even though, I myself, for example, I was adopted into a very loving, caring family, I wanted to know who I was, And so I think it's an existential need that we all have.
The commission has only just begun to look into a few hundred cases. That's out of hundreds of thousands of children who were adopted abroad. And I'm just curious, what is your initial reaction to this official admission from the government?
You know, on the one hand, I felt relief that what we as adopted Koreans have known for many years has been affirmed by a governmental entity. At the same time, I think I just felt a lot of anger, that this was allowed to happen on such a mass scale, and just a tremendous amount of grief for families who have lost children to adoption, for the adopted people, ourselves, and even to the adoptive families. So just to be honest, sometimes I just feel numb about it because it's just so overwhelming. Yeah, just a lot of grief.
I know that several countries that received children from South Korea, they've opened their own investigations. The U.S. is not among them. Would you like to see that happen here?
Absolutely. I think there are hundreds of thousands of people who have been adopted from Korea, Guatemala, China, Colombia, India, etc. How many of these children have similar experiences, falsified documents, or were trafficked? How many of us are searching?
So we have this report now, but I wonder, for you personally, what would you want to see? What would you need to feel a sense of justice, to feel that things are being done right by you?
You know, I think a truth and reconciliation process isn't binding. I know one of the recommendations is to issue a formal apology. I think an apology would be fine, but I think it needs to be followed through concrete action. Adoption agencies are currently transferring records to the government agency called the National Center for the Rights of the Child. That process needs to be better funded and better staffed. I think policy-wise, there still needs to be better financial support and social support for families that are headed by single parents. And I think it's time to end international adoptions from Korea.
That is filmmaker Deanne Borshe-Lim. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We live in a world of increasingly fractured realities, so it can be helpful to look at how current events are playing out in different places. Like the story of Trump officials sharing details of a military operation over a messaging app. Here is NPR's Jude Joffe Block with a look at how it's playing in conservative media and with right-wing influencers.
The editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, published his first article on Monday. It detailed how he was added to a Signal group chat where senior officials shared details about forthcoming U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. Soon, a range of reactions swirled among pro-MAGA influencers and conservative media.
This is called misdirection, and this is called strategy.
After the initial story published, pro-Trump influencer Joey Manarino tried to argue the senior officials had strategically added Goldberg to the chat.
If you think for one second they'd be having these chats over Signal and then be stupid enough to accidentally let a opposition journalist into the chat, man, you really fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. You probably also believe that all the stuff you hear in the news about Trump is real.
The video has more than 2 million views on X. Meanwhile, over on Fox News, Sean Hannity referred to it as a smear from the left.
More feigned phony outrage. This is now the scandal of the week that you will see nonstop, 24/7, that nobody will care about.
Another common narrative on right-wing media was to try to discredit Goldberg, something Trump officials also did in their comments. Welton Chang noticed the effect of this on social media, which he tracks as the CEO of Pira Technologies.
They are criticizing Jeffrey Goldberg for being a member of the chat, and I've seen numerous death threats.
After Trump administration officials insisted nothing classified was discussed, Goldberg published most of the Signal discussion on Wednesday. That same day, pro-Trump influencer Benny Johnson titled his YouTube show Hoax Busted and suggested the supposed deep state could be behind the Signal app.
Maybe that's why they install it on every government agent's phone, so that they'd have a secret back door to all their comms. Maybe, just maybe, this was a op. Maybe, just maybe, this was a new hoax.
But other conservative commentators acknowledged the Trump officials made a mistake. Tommy Lahren posted to X, "Trying to wordsmith the hell out of this Signal debacle is making it worse. It was bad." She advised Trump officials should admit the error and move on. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
And NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of Signal Foundation, which is behind the Signal app.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Okay, baseball fans, you may still be swaddled in layers and layers, but feel that warmth in your heart because it is opening day. The Major League Baseball season has kicked off, so we invited Keith Law from The Athletic to talk us through what we need to know. Keith, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Okay, so we know about Juan Soto leaving the New York Yankees and signing with the New York Mets. Scandal. Everyone is talking about the Los Angeles Dodgers and how they are the team to beat this season. Go Dodgers. That's my home team. But I am curious to find out what under the radar story you will be following this season.
In the American League, the Yankees won the pennant last year, but they have suffered some pretty significant injuries, including the loss of their top starter, Gerrit Cole. And what that's left us with is kind of a very flat American League where I could make decent arguments for probably eight different teams to end up winning the American League pennant. And I think that's going to produce a much more interesting season, whether you're talking about following one team or just looking at the three individual division races. And certainly once we get to the playoffs in October, much more interesting than I think what we had last year in the playoffs, and probably more interesting than what we'll have in the National League. Although I will say the Dodgers have been the team to beat many times in recent years, and they've had lots of early playoff exits before last year's success.
Well, what individual players are you excited to watch this year?
I don't think anybody is set to make a bigger splash than Roki Sasaki, who is the young right-handed pitcher the Dodgers signed from Japan as a limited free agent this past offseason. He has got an unbelievable, unhittable split-fingered fastball. He's been in the upper 90s before. He hasn't pitched that much in his career. He's had some minor injuries that have limited him. So I'll be interested in seeing him pitch and also seeing how they handle his workload going forward.
Well, I mean, the Dodgers, they're coming off a 4-1 World Series win over the Yankees. They are still stacked with all these big name players. So who do you think could really take on the Dodgers this season?
I think the Red Sox have an excellent chance, at the very least, to come out of the American League as the pennant winners this year. They made one of the most significant trades of any contender this offseason, picking up left-handed starter Garrett Crochet in a 4-for-1 trade with the Chicago White Sox. Their top three prospects, the Red Sox top three prospects, that is, are all set to help the Major League team this season, with second baseman Christian Campbell actually winning the job out of spring training. He's going to be in the opening day lineup, and outfielder Roman Anthony not that far behind him. They have really repositioned themselves to be legitimate contenders for the first time in several seasons.
Huh. Okay, let's go back to your predictions for the season. You have the Atlanta Braves beating the Boston Red Sox in the World Series. That's like an annual tradition for you, right?
I joke that making my predictions and having them be wrong is probably my biggest annual tradition. I think last year I had the Yankees finishing in fourth place and they won the pennant. So I don't know how seriously you should take mine. But I will say, I think Atlanta's got a very good chance of beating the Dodgers this year. It's a great offense. When healthy, it's a really good and deep rotation, the kind you could see not just carrying them through a regular season, but holding up against any opposing lineup in the postseason. So I had to pick someone other than the Dodgers, just on principle.
Come on.
And I looked around. You can't, chalk is boring. Nobody wants that. Yeah, absolutely.
Global domination is glorious.
Ugh.
Keith Law is a senior baseball writer for The Athletic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Keith.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Friends and family of a Tufts University student arrested by U.S. immigration officials are frightened and concerned for her safety. In a video obtained by member station WGBH, six plainclothes federal agents stop 30-year-old Rumaysa Ozturk on her way to Ramadan dinner and arrest her on the sidewalk. As Duri Buscarin reports for NPR, her friends and family in Turkey believe her arrest is tied to a doxing campaign by an organization that says it combats anti-Semitism.
Rumaysa Ozturk knew she was being targeted.
She's the sweetest person.
Fatima Tuba Yaylıcı is one of Ozturk's former professors in Istanbul, where she studied child psychology before winning a Fulbright scholarship to the United States.
She texted me and she told me that there is this doxing campaign against her.
Doxing is when online actors publish your personal information online and encourage others to harass you. Think of it as crowdsourced cyberbullying.
I didn't think this is that much of a serious issue, you know.
Yaylıcı says Ozturk asked her to take down photos of her on a university website because Ozturk was worried that her friends in the photos would be targeted too. Recently, a group called the Canary Mission published Ozturk's name and photo on its website. The group says it documents people that promote hatred of the U.S., Israel, or Jews on college campuses. Yaylıcı says that's not who Ozturk is at all.
She's someone who would never harm anyone, who would never discriminate against anyone, let alone being, you know, anti-Semitic or racist or whatever. Never, ever.
The group's complaint about Ozturk is over an op-ed she co-wrote with three other students in Tufts University student newspaper a year ago. The op-ed renewed calls for the university to, quote, acknowledge the Palestinian genocide and to divest from companies with links to Israel. Israel has denied it's committing genocide in Gaza. Rayan Bilge is a psychology professor at Northeastern University who has known Ozturk for a decade. She says it's unclear why she was arrested.
It's probably the op-ed. There is no other explanation, but we don't even know that.
Bilge says Ozturk is a bright student who cares deeply about human rights, children, and the rights of immigrants.
She wasn't active on social media. She wasn't active on any kind of protests. She was a bright student, but a regular student who was here on a valid visa, who was going to school, taking courses, doing everything that was expected of her.
In a statement to NPR, the Department of Homeland Security said Ozturk's student visa was terminated because she allegedly, quote, engaged in activities in support of Hamas. The statement continues, quote, a visa is a privilege, not a right. Glorifying or supporting terrorists who kill Americans is grounds for visa issuance to be terminated. Hamas is not mentioned in the op-ed. That only adds to Bilge's concern.
And that's the scary part, is that if it can be created and these kinds of stories can be concocted for anyone such as Rumaysa, like, it could be for anyone. Anyone could be next.
Ozturk is the third international scholar arrested by ICE and transported to Louisiana who have voiced support for the Palestinian cause on college campuses. Today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to reference these arrests during his speech at an anti-Semitism conference.
We must all commend President Trump's decisive actions against anti-Semitism.
Canary Mission did not respond to a request for comment, but celebrated Ozturk's arrest on social media. For NPR News, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
March 31st marks three decades since the death of Tejano music icon Celina Quintanilla Perez. Across those three decades, Celina's legacy has lived on and even grown through the many ways her fans remember her. Nowhere is that more apparent than in the city where she lived and now rests, Corpus Christi, Texas. Raul Alonso of the Texas Standard visited a few Celina landmarks as the anniversary nears.
I'm standing outside Times Market in the Molina neighborhood of Corpus Christi, admiring a mural to the local girl who became the queen of Tejano. A car pulls up and Vanessa Reyna steps out with her three daughters.
Well, I have 10-year-olds that have been asking to come out here, and we took advantage of spring break to come show them everything.
The family drove 6 hours that morning from the Dallas area to the hometown of one of their favorite singers. and it was all a surprise.
They're like, when are we going to get there? Where are we going? So when we pulled up to the museum, they were just totally stoked.
Molina is the neighborhood Selena called home after the family moved there from the Houston area when she was young. Reina's daughters, including Jaylene, grew to love Selena's music from listening to it in the car.
Or what do you like from Selena?
I like her outfits and the
jewelry?
Yes, that she wore. And I love her records.
Whenever y'all got to the museum, how excited were you?
A 10 out of 10.
The family snaps a few photos in front of the mural before they drive off. The mural is just down the street from the house where Selena once lived, and a field where the West Oso Junior High she attended once stood. It was at West Oso that the young Selena performed Michael Jackson songs during pep rallies. Carmen Tejeda Delgado is a professor at Texas A&M University Corpus Christi. She's also a former schoolmate of Selena's who remembers the rallies. She says the singer's connection to the working class neighborhood and the city as a whole remains strong.
We see her, I think, as, you know, a barrio girl, a home girl, somebody who is there with us.
Fans visiting Corpus Christi find no shortage of landmarks to the singer of Como La Flor. Many stop at the Mirador de la Flor, on the street along the city's shoreline. The white gazebo-like structure houses a life-sized bronze statue of Selena that looks out onto the bay. Tens of thousands visit yearly from all over the world. Many pose for photos leaning on the rails that surround it. Before the railing was up, many visitors even wrote personal messages to the singer they so admired. Texas author Deborah Paredes wrote a book about the many ways people remember Selena.
She was so much kind of a symbol of promise that I think that those things make her uniquely available to us to continue to deposit our dreams for what could be, and also our grief over what could not be.
Selena was shot and killed by a fan when she was just 23. Today, people who want to honor her memory can visit the Mirador and the mural, along with a museum, an auditorium, and, of course, her resting place at Seaside Memorial Park Cemetery. But for my last stop, I dropped in for lunch at what was her favorite, Taqueria, the Hi-Ho restaurant, not far from her neighborhood. Photographs of the singer and her band, Los Dinos, line shelves and walls. And in a corner booth near the entrance is the spot she liked to sit to enjoy her favorite dish of carne guisada. It's one of several points of interest for fans found on maps listing landmarks around the city. And it's a place where, 30 years later, visitors can sit and reflect on Selena's influence and legacy. In Corpus Christi, I'm Raul Alonso for NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice shrubs offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Be ready when it come, oh Lord, he's coming again so soon. Jesus did come and did his will again, coming to judge the hearts of men. Don't let him catch your heart filled with sin. He's coming again so soon. Be ready when he comes. year.